Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAKorea.com and Vero-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and you are listening to the HR Power Hour, educational HR radio. Today, our guests are from Culture Plus. It's Frank Dana and Chris Petrie, co-founders of Culture Plus. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you today?
Doing great.
Awesome. We love that. Doing great.
Yeah, David, hello.
Well, hello. It's all good, right? And we're talking about love. So let's share some, right? Share the love. It's all good today. No, it's awesome. So I always like to ask when people write books, why? What would possess you to write a book? Frank?
So here's the deal. I mean, there are so many business books out there around so many topics. I personally don't even like the... I don't even like the business book segment. And I apologize to all the people that read business books or that write business books that are now offended. I've taken me less than 45 seconds and I've ruined people's days. However, a lot of times when I'm reading a book about business, what I'm reading is theory. I'm reading a lot of examples of people that have stepped in perfect simulated environments to showcase how they would approach doing X, Y, or Z. And so what drove us to write a book was our lived experiences as business leaders, from all of the mistakes that we had made and the stories that we had kind of found along the way. We decided it was good to write a book that would kind of break the cliche of what a business book should be and how it should be structured and communicated. And that's essentially why we wrote it, because we felt like we had a story to tell, not from the perspective of perfection, but from please learn from our mistakes. Please grow from the experiences that we have had to grow from, and to try to prove out this framework that we had discovered as we went from a toxic work environment, really a place that people hated to come to work, into a place where, as the book suggests, there was a little bit more love. And so it became very natural for us to want to write a book like this, because as people heard our story and we started to share what we had experienced, they said, it's time for you to do it. So we wanted to write it, but we also wanted to write it a little bit differently than what you'd expect from a typical business book.
Chris, one of the things I thought was interesting, it talked about this is love that you've never seen. This is love that leans into the hard conversations, a love that is equal parts inclusion and accountability, a love that focuses on solutions rather than dwelling on problems, a love that gets results. Talk about that a little.
Yeah. So we know that love is a soft topic. It's a soft word. It's typically seen in the romantic sense. And when we came up with the culture of love and really wanting to follow that, that means that when you really love someone, that means that you are doing what's best for them, even when they aren't doing that themselves. It also means being able to have feedback flowing freely to where, whether it's going to a leader and saying, hey, what you just did back there created this outcome. Or it made me feel this way. Let's talk about it. Let's get to the root of it. But also, out of that conversation, we have results. We have new ideas. We have new perspectives. We have growth. And a lot of times when companies speak to needing those positive outcomes, they don't talk about the how. How do you get there, right? It's very easy to use process and hierarchy to get results, right? But those things aren't sustainable. So when we were thinking about our culture and we were really applying these concepts, we wanted to make sure that when we use the word love, that we're not flowery, that it still means that things get done. It still means that we are serious and we take things seriously that need to be taken seriously, but we're not so serious that we can't take the time to laugh, to have fun, to appreciate one another, to be sort of enjoying the process and the challenges and the obstacles, right? Because life is too short. And so we see, though, that all that you just read as a basis for what love can be if you want it to. It does not have to be that scary HR word that people run from because they think of sort of the entanglements that people can get into.
Romance.
yeah, it's like, that's not what it's about. But, you know, we look at it from the place of when you put people at the center of your decisions, when you look at your financials and you look at all of the numbers that live in your financial sheets, all of that is tied to someone's behavior or a team's behavior or a leader's behavior. And if we're not careful, we can find ourselves trying to use process to fix numbers that people are hurting, helping, or ignoring, right? And so that's critical for us.
No, I think it's awesome. I think it's a very interesting way of looking at it. And certainly you're really talking about obviously using empathy and using a degree of really connecting to people as well as still holding people accountable and making sure that the job still gets done in a collective way. So that makes sense. Well, let's get started in the sense of giving us a little bit of a background. Frank, where'd you come from? You know, how'd you get to where you are today? How'd this all start? And how'd you get to work for a company that you hated at one point?
Well, listen, first of all, yeah, that's a great question. So I started my career early on in the technology space, helping to build and design mobile applications after the App Store went live in 2009, 2010. And we started working with a small startup here in Houston that was building mobile applications for different industries and organizations. And I pivoted from that into, you know, a very strange space, but it was in social media content creation on a platform called Vine. If anyone has ever heard of Vine.
Yes, I do actually know what that is.
One of the first paid social influencers and began working with numerous brands around the world. My organization that I built, a small little agency creating content for brands, was acquired by Softway. And so that's how I came to be a part of this team in 2014. And that's a little bit about me. I mean, I sped through a lot of the life there, but it got me into the organization and got me into a position of leadership relatively early on alongside of, well, Chris joined a couple of years later, but Chris, go ahead and share your stuff.
Yep. Just for clarity for any listener out there, we started with Softway and Softway spun out Culture Plus because of the work that we did with our culture and our clients wanting that in addition to our technology services. So we wanted to create two entities that deal with different things. But
absolutely,
I joined Softway. And you know, at that time, this was back in 2016. And this was right in the thick of that hatred period that you referenced, right? So I joined this organization and I brought in to, you know, help change things and fix things. But this is like the lowest point of the organization, right? 2 weeks after my start date is when we have a big set of layoffs. And they're handled in ways that I just, you know, you have to read the book to find out, but handled in ways that you wouldn't believe, but oftentimes are seen as standard or maybe, you know, normal in other corporate environments. But for me, it was just like, what? I've never seen an organization lay people off in such an inhumane and sort of cold way. And so that triggered a response to where our senior most leader, Muhammad, change things. And, you know, he changed himself first and then invited his leaders to change with him. Those that did not want to change were invited to take their talents to other places. And those who were on the journey went forward. And as a result of that, we started to transform. But, you know, I've been a part of this organization. And before that, been in sales roles, social media management roles, digital consulting roles, marketing automation roles. And so all of those talents came here in a perfect culmination to support everything that we're doing and everything that we do with our clients.
Chris, you mentioned that you have to internally look first, right? You talked about how Muhammad had to fix himself first, right? In terms of before the culture could be fixed. And I think if you talk about the book itself, that probably is a big part of where you introspectively have to go in first to look at it and look at yourself and look at everybody within that. And Chris, I'll stick with you for a minute on this. Did you find that hard to do initially? Is it hard to look internally and say something could be wrong with me? Because I know nothing could be wrong with Frank.
Nothing's wrong with Frank. Frank was perfect when we got him in. But
this is a great podcast. I'm loving this conversation. This is fantastic.
I'm just going to speak personally and candidly. I think one of the biggest things that goes unchecked inside of many leaders, and whether they, I'm brave enough to admit my vulnerability here and say, arrogance is a really hard thing to admit to. And when I mean arrogance, it's not like I'm better than everybody. It's really intellectual arrogance. I know what I know and what I know is best. And therefore, anyone who tries to compete with that is wrong, different, excluded, not here for me, whatever the case may be, right? And so for me, it was having that moment of self-reflection and introspection to say, why am I not willing to be wrong? And why am I not willing to listen to others? And when we work with clients, that's oftentimes the first thing we get greeted with is that intellectual arrogance, that I know what I need to know. And if it doesn't come from these certain people that I trust, it is not going to be considered. And that was something that was truly difficult for me. And even I can speak for Muhammad too, because again, you are taught to be your own man. You are taught to make decisions. Your whole sort of setup going into a business school and university is that you as a leader are measured on your ability to make decisions. And you get out into the real world and that stays with you and you build a persona around it. You build an ego around it. You build a legacy around it, right? And unfortunately, what I did not learn in college was that behaviors matter, was that how you treat people actually can carry you further than the decisions that you make. And while I'm not sort of negating the decision-making aspect of leadership, and while I'm not saying that you can be dumb and still lead people, I am saying that if you put more weight on one and not the other, you do have a lopsided organization and a lopsided team.
No, you're spot on. And certainly by the way, you're listening to the HR Power Hour, educational HR radio. Frank, you know, your journey of learning introspectively about yourself, how difficult was that?
I think for me, it was challenging because I didn't fully recognize my role as someone who was a leader in the organization. I didn't see my impact of my behaviors actually having an outsized impact on other people. And it's until I realized that every choice that I made had the opportunity to build the culture up or tear the culture down, what we like to refer to as there not being any neutral interactions, right? As a leader, I had to recognize that my interactions with other people were either positive or negative. Once I started to recognize that and see that, it became clear to me that there was an area for me to improve, that I needed to begin my journey of introspection and self-discovery and self-awareness, because you can't expect your culture or anyone around you to develop faster than you do as a leader. You have to go first. You have to set the tone for others to follow. And if you're not willing to do that, and if I wasn't willing to do that, then you're ultimately not going to see improvements in your own life or in the improvements of the culture that you're trying to create. So that really was an impact for me of when I recognized I really do have, like, if behavior is culture, then the way I behave sets the tone. Piece by piece, day by day, it reflects the actual organization. And once I got that, I thought, okay, how do I need to improve myself and what should I do to grow?
A lot of people may feel this way. And one of the things that I find interesting is that they have to take that first step, right? They have to actually acknowledge and recognize what is sometimes hard to acknowledge and recognize. And there becomes this element of not only internally recognizing, but being able to tell others that you've made a mistake or that you have to do something differently and having that conversation. You know, Frank, when you're talking to the people you've been in charge of for a while and saying, I'm going to be different, is it as much telling them, showing them? Give us a combination of the two about that dialogue and that feel and that fit.
I think the best story to tell is Muhammad's in this case, because Muhammad was the CEO of this company, Softway, and he, after what we call our darkest day, a few weeks after, he went to a football game, and his alma mater is the University of Houston Cougars. And so he went to a football game, was there, and they were bombing. They were doing so bad. And people were leaving the stadium in the third quarter because of how bad this team was losing by like 20, 30 points. But he decided with his brother that he was going to stick around. And he saw, as a result of him staying at this game, one of the greatest college football comebacks in the history of the sport, at least for that school. And it was coached by a then new coach, Tom Herman. And he was so inspired at the end of the game because the Cougs pulled out this incredibly miraculous win that he listened to the press conference a few days later. And Tom Herman was having a conversation with the reporters about the culture of their team. And he said, this team loves each other. They care about each other. It's beyond just this, like, hey, I got your back, whatever. It's this, I hold my heart in your hands. Like, you hold my heart, I hold your heart. We care for each other. And Muhammad attributes that moment to him thinking to himself, do I care for my team? do I really care? And the next Friday, he came to us as an organization and said, I'm ready to start caring for this company. I'm ready to start loving this company. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what that could be, but I know that the way that I've led this organization has been terrible. And I'm willing to try if you're willing to give me a chance. Many people heard that as all talk, a flavor of the month. This guy's just doing this because he wants to get his money back. He wants to do all the things that will get him back to his seat as CEO. But what we ended up seeing over the course of the next weeks and months and years was someone who dedicated himself to furthering that vision beyond what anyone had ever thought possible. And so my answer to you in that long-winded story is it is a combination. You have to obviously set the precedent for the team or the group of people you're communicating with, letting them know that the journey you're taking is going to be one that you are and probably will be making mistakes on, but asking them to give you a chance. And what's most important, in my opinion, is creating an environment around you as a leader where you ask for people to tell you and communicate with you openly when you are messing up and need to be called out. You need to have that support system in place, because the reality is none of us are perfect. We're not claiming to be perfect or have it all figured out. What we are saying is if you choose to step into this lifestyle of reliable and servant leadership, which is essentially what we're communicating in the book, you're also choosing loneliness if you don't invite other people in and have them help you stay accountable to the words you've said so they become the actions that people begin to mirror.
We're going to talk about that and more about the book when we come right back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk 100.5 FM. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, HR Educational Radio. Today, our guests are co-founders of Culture Plus. They are Frank Dana and Chris Petrie. They are both also authors of the book, Love as a Business Strategy, Resilience, Belonging, and Success. That's what we're talking about today in the second section. Love is a business strategy. So, you know, I had an opportunity to look at some of the parts of the book. And one of the things that struck me is understanding the culture of love. And you talk about inclusion, empathy, vulnerability, trust, empowerment, and forgiveness. It's an interesting choice of words. Why those words, Chris?
Those words were very intentional, and we spent a lot of time really dissecting those. So the first thing that we noticed is that when it comes to inclusion, that's an intentional behavior, right? If you are walking into a room and you're not hearing all the voices, are you even asking yourself why you didn't hear those voices? Are you aware that all the voices weren't speaking up, right? And that when we talk about inclusion, we're really talking about engaging that diversity around you. And when we say diversity, that means perspectives, people, attitude, lifestyles, everything, right? And once you have sort of that invitation out there for everyone to participate, then you have the ability to empathize with what's being said, with what experiences are coming forth, what you are learning from clients, from your peers, from your leaders, even interviewees, whoever you are in front of. And once you have that empathy, then you can actually start building bonds of trust, where we're talking about deeper levels of trust, not that surface trust where you can predict what someone's going to do, so you trust they're going to do the same things over and over again. We're talking about where you get to know them as humans, as fallible, as, you know, mistake-driven, you know, individuals that are capable of succeeding as well as failing. And, you know, sharing in those vulnerable moments, you can have a trust that allows for you to really understand how do you now empower those flawed individuals, right? Because empowerment is really about making sure they're set up for success. It's making sure they have what they need, that they're truly capable of doing those things that you're asking them to do. But ultimately, you've made it truly possible for them to succeed. And you're not just assuming or saying, I'm delegating and however you do it is you're on you. And if you mess up, I'm taking my ball back, right? Which is how typically we see empowerment in organizations. When you have empowered people, then you have vulnerability. Hey, you asked me to do this and I dropped the ball. Oh my gosh, let's talk about it. We can fix it. Like it's proactive conversation and communication around misses. Not let's hide it and cover it up and report it as, you know, successful when really it is a bad thing, right? And we've heard clients that say, especially in high safety cultures, you know, and an accident where someone passes away sounds like a retirement party by the time it gets to the CEO, right? And so when you have that type of environment and that sort of lack of vulnerability, you can't get to a place of forgiveness. And this is for us an intentional word because I work in so many organizations where you hold on to things, right? And you may not communicate, but you definitely remember. And it comes critical when it's time to promote, when it's time to hire, when it's time to let people go, when it's time to, you know, do whatever it is that could impact someone's career or success. And we believe that forgiveness is one of the most missing elements in many corporate environments to this day. And so those words were super intentional. And hopefully that you see the connective tissue between all those six words. And for us, when you have all six of those things, you're firing on all cylinders. We look at it as a six-cylinder engine, right? Not having one means that you might be missing an opportunity to be higher performing as an organization.
You know, Frank, Chris just talked a little bit about trust and forgiveness, two very, very big and powerful words. Probably the ones I look at, the words you put up here, those are the two that just stick out as just the headlights of what's moving forward. Trust can be earned and trust can be lost quickly. How do you look at that word trust and say, yes, I'm still going to make mistakes? And how do you make it so that trust is less vulnerable to the person in that culture?
You know, trust is, like you mentioned, a huge, huge word. And I think what's important to understand about trust is, like Chris mentioned, there are different levels of trust that you can have with people. What I'd suggest to a senior leader, someone who's interested in building more trust, is how willing are you to trust other people? Are you stepping into a conversation or a relationship already from a place of not willing to trust the other person, not willing to be honest and open and communicative around a problem that you may have had or a solution that needs to be done? What is your silence costing you? And I would challenge you to think about whether or not trust is really part of how you work and operate, and if it's part of your organization. And I know I'm going introspective here, but trust really comes down to whether or not you see another person as capable. And what Chris mentioned were two different types of trust that we often see in the workplace. Both are able to get work done, but one actually links up with the other pillars in a way that creates high performance. And that's really what the goal of this, these six pillars are ending up doing, is creating high performance. And if you wanted to, how we define love, these six pillars are how we define love. This is the actionable, tangible words that we use to say, this is why love is a business strategy. There are two different types of trust, the vulnerable trust and the predictive trust. And what we're suggesting is predictive trust only sees people as what they have been doing before. What you've done before is my measuring rod for what you're going to be able to do and perform later. So that's the willingness and extent I'm willing to go for you to perform. But vulnerability-based trust is built on all the other pillars that Chris mentioned. That's the type of trust that gives people the empowerment to go beyond their skill sets. That's the type of trust that imbues the vulnerability and the ability to forgive. And it's not, by vulnerability, we're not saying deepest, darkest secrets here, because I think that word is also something that people are getting either confused or worried about. When we say vulnerability, especially for leadership, the way we define it is as simply as owning up to your mistakes. and being willing to show others that it's okay to apologize or to showcase that you're imperfect. So when you're able to trust in a way that allows people to go beyond their skill sets, it is unbelievable what actually happens in the relationship with that other person and a team. But it comes back to you. Are you willing to trust that person? And then if you're not willing to trust them, ask yourself the question of why. Why am I not willing to go all the way here? Why am I not willing to do what needs to be done? Am I holding on to unforgiveness? Am I not willing to be empathetic? Going into that space helps you understand your level of trust in your organization.
Well, it must have been a big swing, Chris, when Muhammad made a decision to go from a culture of, well, let's just put it in a very technical way, not so good, to a culture exactly. of good, right? I'm just trying to be very technical here today.
This is fantastic.
And trust probably was lost a lot in the organization at that point.
Yeah.
And forgiveness was probably, if nothing else, probably the biggest key, but it was all about actions, I'm sure, right? Yes. To mm-hmm. actually prove mm-hmm. it. So what were some of the things, high level, that Muhammad did or he got the leadership team to do to change that in the organization? Give a top level line yes. stuff.
Yeah. So service became a huge part of our road back to redemption. So when I say service, it doesn't mean like, yes, we serve food. Like we are a food-based culture. Like we love eating as a team, especially before pandemic. We were like, we ate and we had quality food. I should put that.
Not, we're
not
talking good.
Pizza, not pizza and sandwiches.
And
yeah, pizza. Not pizza and sandwiches. Okay. We have people that don't like pizza on our team. So we were having catered hot foods from all around the world brought in. Like that's when we say serve, we're talking like good food that you don't want to, you know, pass on a second plate. And then that led into, okay, how do we now transform the way that we manage projects as leaders, right? How do we help sit beside people who are struggling with understanding what to do or what to do next? How do we set things up to where they are capable of sort of owning the work? And more importantly, how do we put them in front of clients so that they feel like they are able to really represent their own work, right? So we found these ways that were both, you know, I would say social in terms of service, as well as professional in terms of service to really set people up for a future that was successful. So service was like the paramount thing that we really tried to do to really rebuild and restore trust, but more importantly, to lead towards the road to a relationship that had forgiveness baked in.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour. Of course, I'm your host, David Chugo, and it's Educational HR Radio. And just as a reminder, the show is podcast on all major podcast channels. And of course, you can go to hrpowerhour.com at any time to listen to any show. So Frank, you know, of course, we're talking with Frank and Chris. They're both co-founders of Culture Plus, and they're also, of course, we're talking about the book, Love is a Business Strategy, Resilience, Belonging, and Success. Frank, what was the big moment when somebody was changing the culture, when somebody was, you know, said they were going to do all this? When did you actually believe? How long did it take till you went, I think he's actually for real? I'll go to both of you on that. I'll start with you, Frank, but both of you. When was it like, I know he's saying it, I kind of want to believe, just not so sure.
It was about a year after he had made the commitment that I walked into my office and I saw a note on my desk, and it was around the holiday season. And we had been putting in a tremendous amount of hours as a result of having to do some layoffs and not having enough really team members to support the work that we were trying to accomplish. And so all of us were putting in extra work. It was just about the end of the day. And I sat down at my desk and opened the note, had no idea who it was from. And it was from Muhammad. And it was the first letter I'd received from him or from any leader. And the letter actually wasn't written to me. It was written to my wife and my children. And he was thanking them for the sacrifices that I had made, but also that they had made for not seeing me and not spending time with me and all the missed moments over the past several months that I had not been at home, that I hadn't been had a chance to go out to the movies with them or take them out to eat or do something impactful as a family. And he left me some money in the card. And again, the money wasn't just as a bonus. The money was, Frank, I recognize that there's time that you've had away from your family. Please use this small token of my appreciation to do something with them to make memories with your family. That tangible moment, a switch flipped in my heart. And I thought, I've never seen anyone go to this level of empathy for my situation at home. And I really saw the care and the nurturing and the love in that action, because I'd never seen a leader say, I know you've missed time with your wife and kids, and I want to make sure that you can go do something with them. Here's money to do it. I later found out that that was out of his own pocket. It wasn't from the company's coffers. It was him trying to, again, sacrifice monetarily to make sure that I was taken care of. But that was the moment for me.
Chris, how about you? That's a great story, by the way, Frank, because that really showcases it, doesn't it? Really does.
Yeah. One of the memorable moments for me was, one thing about Muhammad is that, you know, when he got upset, he got irate to like yelling and screaming. It's true. It's in the book. It's in the book, right? And when he started this journey, he would pull me aside and like, Chris, like, I'm just an angry person. I was like, I had to stop him. Like, Muhammad, you're a person who gets angry. You are not an angry person. As long as you say that, you're owning anger, and that is going to be your identity. I'd rather you see yourself as someone who is capable of loving and having all these other emotions and not just being angry. And so he was asking me, he's like, what do I do? And I'm like, I gave him a whole bunch of things. Well, fast forward about 2 or 3 weeks after that conversation, we were in a sales meeting. And, you know, you could tell he was like getting that, like, you could almost like see the blood like coming to his face. Yeah, the vein.
There's
starts
a vein.
Like, yeah. You know, and what he said was like, you guys, I'm disappointed. And here is what disappointed me. And here were my expectations. I want this to get better. And here's what I'm looking for from you all. I'm going to leave this meeting because I don't want to say anything to upset you all, but just know that I'm disappointed. And he picks himself up and leaves the room. No yelling. And I'm like, you know, slow clap moment, right? Like, because it was a much more effective way of getting his desire across. And he still could address his feelings. He was still emotional, but he was effective in his communication. And when you have a leader that is that self-aware to know that I am angry on the inside, I'm boiling, but I don't have to act in that anger. I can still use my words to communicate to someone to help them understand where I am, but also what I need. And so that for me was the pinnacle moment where I knew, like, okay, he's committed to this, because that takes a lot of self-control, a lot of self-awareness, and a lot of empathy to know that someone has disappointed you and to still give them the respect, the humanity, and sort of that ability to recover and redeem themselves at some point.
There's no question that takes a lot of internal change to make that happen. Yeah. And I suspect as the organization over the last couple of years and has watched the change and has made it happen, it's probably made it easier to hire talent, to bring people into the organization. Talk a little bit about what it's done on the positive side. Chris, I'll stick with you on that. Go ahead. Tell me the positive side on that.
So recruiting became a breeze because we had more referrals than you can begin to think about. When it came to open positions, we shortened and sort of halved our time to recruit and get people in the door. But more importantly, we actually fundamentally changed how we recruited and how we interviewed and how we onboarded to ensure that what we said we were actually showed up in processes, it showed up in experiences, and it showed up in conversation, right? And we departed from the tricks that we used to do. I'm talking to some HR leaders here. So, you know, we stopped having the good cop, bad cop routine. We stopped having sort of the let's throw them off their game and see how they recover. All of those things that aren't really true inside of our organization. We don't have clients that do that. We don't do that to each other. So why would we try and do that in an interview? Because if we want to test someone's innovation, we want to make sure that we are giving them the ability to really think and be strategic, but also show us who they are and how they work. So we really transformed our processes and tried to make them feel comfortable, feel at home when they came in. And ultimately, when they onboarded with us, we gave them what they needed to be successful starting day one.
And that's going to tie in perfectly to the next segment, where we're going to talk about the part three of the book, Putting Love to Work. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAKorea.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and you are listening to HR Educational Radio. And once again, remember that HR Power Hour is on your favorite podcast channel, Spotify, iTunes, Pandora, all of the good stuff out there. Go out there and check it out. Like us and listen each and every week. You can go to HRPowerHour.com and sign up for our weekly e-blast and know what's coming up. Again, we appreciate it and thank all our sponsors of the show as well. Today, of course, we're talking to two co-founders of Culture Plus, Frank Dana and Chris Petrie, and we are talking about their book, Love as a Business Strategy, Resilience, Belonging, and Success. We're sharing the love here. That's what we do, we're sharing the love. All right there, Chris, I got a question for you. Part three of the book says put love to work. And section 12 talks about HR, humanity required. Now, you're talking to a bunch of HR professionals, C-suite leaders, senior HR professionals.
Yes.
So please get this one right, please, because I'd like them back next week on the show. Chris, okay.
Chris,
so Chris,
I'm looking
it's
at
all
you, man.
About you, man. Let's make it happen.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, so when we talk about HR from a love as a business strategy perspective, you know, one of the things that I will honestly say, and again, this is where I might rub some people wrong, but hopefully I can come back and recover them. But I've always been in organizations where HR felt like a friend to the business, but not always a friend to the humans in the business. And when I say that, what I mean is it seems like there's a view that humans are liabilities and costs. And we have to limit those liabilities and reduce those costs. And therefore, we will create process and policies that reflect that. And I come from the school where HR is really meant to empower and employ and protect and support the people and see people as a conduit to profits. I don't believe that people, you know, and profits are antagonistic. They should be protagonistic or complementary to each other. And so with that, we believe in sort of a theory why approach where if we hired you, that meant that we trusted you, which means that we didn't bring in people who were dumb, who were intending to do evil. We don't bring in people who are trying to sort of ruin our relationships with our customers. If we vetted you and took you through that HR hiring process, then when you come in our doors, you should feel somewhat respected, valued, and wanted, desired even from day one. And so we had to re-engineer our policies. We had to re-engineer our processes around people to really reflect that mentality that, hey, if you came here and you showed up to do your best work today, then why am I creating a system that's going to make you feel like you are a child, that makes you feel like you are a slave even, right? And that's an aggressive term. But just to give you an example, in our India office, we had a policy where you had to sort of put your fingerprint or thumbprint on the doors to get from floor to floor. And you can imagine during company meetings, during, you know, large meetings, people are literally piled up on the staircase, you know, waiting for someone to, you know, badge in through their fingerprint scan. And I'm sitting here like, this is a fire hazard, first of all. Second of all, like, what does this say that? And what we would do is we would look at people's behaviors, like how long are they going out for lunch? How long has it been since their finger scan, right? And then that would create a cycle after that where they would get reprimanded. And if they were gone too long, pay could get cut, et cetera. And I was like, we have knowledge workers. These are knowledge workers. These are people that are coming in. And if they need a 15-minute longer lunch break today, like give it to, like, you know, like if they get their work done and if they're meeting their deadlines, why does it matter how long they take? And I know that goes against everything that industrial society has said that we need to do in terms of managing workers. But I fundamentally believe that when we look at our policies, again, the key word to policy is policing. And when we look at our policies, right, what is it that we truly want to police? And to me, someone's coming and going, if we say that we trust them, should not be it. Life happens. There are realities beyond people's control sometimes. And, you know, if their work performance is affected, let's talk about that. But I don't need to punish everybody because some people may not know how to manage or may not be effective in their work. The other thing is really looking at how we are handling performance management. I've worked for large organizations. Performance management typically equates to salary compression. Just being honest, right? Like, how do we keep people from earning too much too fast, right? So, you know, every rubric is different. Every leader has their own sort of agenda when it comes to performance management. And ultimately, you're not managing performance. You're really trying to compress salaries. But true performance management, those should be an active and a daily interaction. It shouldn't be once a year, once a quarter, right? And to me, it should also be inclusive of the behaviors you see exhibited by that individual, not just the quote unquote achievements or the competence you see, right? We even switch from using competence to capability because we want to look at people's potential, not just what they're competent in, because sometimes everyone doesn't get exposed to the same opportunities or have the same access to opportunities as others. So someone may be capable of doing something that their competence may not reflect if you're just going purely there, right? So when we talk about putting love to work, we are talking about really rethinking how we are constructing policies, but how people are living in those policies. And if we hold our people as sacred, then policies and processes should always be the things that change, not the way that we treat our people.
Well, that fits right into the chapter 13, which is systems, people, process, and technology. Frank, how does that dovetail directly into what Chris is talking about from an HR humanity standpoint?
100%. So the story that we tell in the story, the actual book, has a lot to do with what Chris mentioned, these biometric scanners, right? And at first, there were these intentions around creating this new process where people have to sign in when they come to work. And ultimately, that approach sounded good on paper. Like, hey, we're actually going to have more transparency and clarity about how people were showing up to work. Well, the reality was, if people accidentally forgot or show up late, they would get their pay docked as a result of this. And this approach that was happening was a process that was established that sounded like it came from this pure intention perspective. But if you look at it, many businesses look at processes as if they occurred in a vacuum, like a set of gears in a machine. But all processes are made by people. And when people are faced with challenges, most businesses try to solve them by adding more process. And for years, we were no different. Our executive leadership team was full of industry vets. We were convinced that we had to have processes established as the way to move forward. And every bit of process that we added, results never changed. Sales never improved. Engagement didn't increase. Our results got worse as we added more processes and tools. And the problem was we were actually having a people problem, because you can have as many alignment meetings as you want, but if the people in that room don't feel empowered to do their jobs, if they don't feel that they can trust each other or that you have the best interest in mind, you're still going to have issues. And no one will be invested in fixing those issues. This is why, to us, those six pillars that we talked about earlier are so important, that they remind us, like Chris mentioned, that the fundamental humanity is what we want to focus our energy on. So when it comes to creating new policies and new processes and choosing the technology that you're utilizing, you have to think about it from a people lens. How is this going to impact real people? How are individuals going to be impacted in a way that doesn't build resentment and anger and lack of trust or empathy? How are these processes and policies going to impact people in the correct way? Because ultimately, a lot of the policies and processes that are in organizations right now are designed for those people that misbehaved. They're designed to make sure that the people that misbehave don't misbehave again. But guess what? A vast majority of the time, it's a very small percentage of people inside of companies that are actually taking advantage of or misbehaving. So deal with those individuals individually. Don't take it out on the entire organization and create these overwhelming processes and structures that essentially create resentment among people who are just showing up to do the best work they possibly can. And so when you have love as a business strategy, you're really starting to not think about just the folks that are misbehaving and how can we add these new policies so they won't wreck the unlimited vacation that we have at their disposal. How can we create policies that are fair and equitable? And if there are individuals that are coming out of the woodwork to take advantage of it, how can we create an appropriate response for those people to make sure that they are communicated and dealt with effectively and not put the burden on everyone else.
Chris, that is exactly what most people say happens in most organizations. They hit a nail with a massive hammer rather than a nice little tack hammer, right? You come in and you just put a policy in place to solve the one person out of the hundred. And you're doing it because it's the easy way. It feels equitable and fair if you do that. You're doing it for everybody. But in fact, there's nothing more aggravating for everybody else to do that. The other side of that is certainly great performers, top A performers, your high, fully engaged performers, hate it when people aren't actually held accountable. Hate it when you don't actually hold that one person, that two person accountable. How do you balance the accountability with making sure the balance is there and making sure that the humanity is taken care of?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I like to really dive into is what do we mean by accountability? So oftentimes when people mean accountability, they mean humiliation, embarrassment, like making sure that they are publicly recognized for their lack of achievement. And that is not what we mean by accountability. Accountability, like I always go back to parenting. And when I think about my mom, the first time she reminds me, it's nice. It might be baked into a joke. It might be a push. It might be a nudge, right? Like, it's not this aggressive, like, okay, you just lost rights and access and all this stuff. And typically that's what we equate to accountability is punishment. And so when we say accountability, there are measures and escalations that you can take in order to get someone to follow or do what they committed to. And so it may not be done in a public way. So those high performers who are looking for, you know, someone to be held to a public, you know, flogging, so to speak, right? Like, that is not what we mean. And if that's what you need for your coworkers to feel like they belong, like, I'm looking at you now to say, like, well, what's going on with your forgiveness situation? What's going on with, like, with your mentality, if that's what you're looking for? But one-on-one, I can be holding someone accountable, but they may not be known to everybody. And so when we think about accountability, we think that having hard, tough conversations are absolutely essential. It's just that those should be happening one-on-one. You know, you, praise in public, coach in private, right? And so if you are a high performer and you are a peer, or you're not willing to go and give your peer that feedback, then just know that that could be happening away from you. But we still believe that that is a critical part of keeping love as a business strategy alive.
And that's what we're talking about. Your book, Love is a Business Strategy, Resilience, Belonging, and Success. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk 100.5 FM. And we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, HR Educational Radio. Again, we're podcasted live on Spotify. We're on iTunes. We're on Pandora. We're on iHeartRadio. Yes, we're out there. Go and check us out. We appreciate it. Today, of course, we're talking to the co-founders of Culture Plus. We're talking to Frank Dana and Chris Petrie. They are going to be talking about and wrapping up the Love is a Business Strategy book, Resilience, Belonging, and Success. Okay, I've listened to you guys now for 3/4 of the show. I'm coming to the end of the show. The audience is going, hey, it sounds pretty interesting. I'm interested in buying the book. I just don't know, why should I really buy the book? What am I going to get out of this book? What is it that's the big wins for me? And I'll let either one of you take that one today.
So as Frank mentioned at the very start of this, this is not your traditional business book. The feedback that we've been getting from a lot of readers and those who've enjoyed the book is that it feels like you are reading a story. It's more like a novel because we have so much of our lived experience in it and the practicality of it, to where we've had people come back and say, I was able to change this one thing and it made a huge impact. And so we see that there's a lot of real world examples, but also real easy takeaways that you can take from this book and implement in your own business or your own team, regardless of what role you have. And so we've seen and heard from so many different folks, and we've gotten, you know, large organizations even coming in saying, hey, this book really changed our perspective on how we can manage and lead this company or this organization or team. Can you come and talk to everybody for us? So if you want those insights, those action items, and those takeaways that can help you starting tomorrow, feel free to get a copy. You know, and if you have questions, reach out. We're also extremely accessible. So we're not those authors that hide behind the shadows or behind these really large social presences that are basically phantom organizations. We are accessible. So we're also available to answer questions.
You know, to build on that, this is for anyone who is working in a job and wishes that things were different, that wish that people would just behave in ways that build value and respect. And if you're looking for a change and you're tired of the status quo, that's who this book was written to. Anyone in any level of any organization, we've outlined what we call our framework, that something that we discovered again through our massive mistakes, and we give it to everybody on page 29. It's there. And what we've done today is actually walk through the different components of the framework and how to put it to work. So we encourage anyone who's looking to make a change, who's looking to grow professionally, and who wants to see a different perspective, an alternate reality. That's what this book is designed for. And that's who we wrote it for.
No, that's awesome. And I think you guys have really done a great job with it. You know, as I wrap up the show today, we've got about a minute or so left. I got to ask, Chris, it says here in your bio, and he's like, uh-oh, what did you read in my bio, that you like anthropology? Yes.
So I love studying people, people watching, but also civilizations and whatnot. And so when I travel, I don't listen to music or headphones because I want to hear the language. I want to hear how people speak. I want to hear the words. I want to hear how they interact when they are sort of quote unquote in their own world. I've always enjoyed that. And that can be true going into a client organization. I don't listen to music. I listen to the sounds of the world, of the atmosphere, because you get to pick up a lot on things.
Great. Frank, you're a huge pop culture nerd, it says in here. What's your big top pop culture you love?
I'm a huge fan of anything that has to do with Marvel. I'm a big fan of any sort of fantasy and sci-fi. I'm a poster collector of unique limited edition prints that really reflect like the movies and TV shows that I love to watch. And I'm a huge fan overall of how incredible the storytelling is on TV and movies today.
No, that's awesome. A little something to think about when and if you ever connect with Chris and Frank. Gentlemen, I appreciate so much you being on the show today and sharing about your book. I think everybody really should go out and take a look at this. It's something that is a great read. And as you said, Chris, a nice, simple storytelling read. It's very well put together and very well done. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.